constant and intense pressure to get people to move. In reality, each tenant was approached with an offer of help and relocation. If our offer was turned down, which was usually the case, since the tenants had agreed to oppose us on everything, that was the end of it. Some tenants even told us that they had been warned by the tenants' committee not to consider our offer. The irony is that we might well have been able to offer better alternatives to the tenants who lived in the less desirable apartments. The one thing I can't deny is that claiming harassment was a clever tactic. Harassment is a virtual buzzword in New York. It prompts instant images of vicious landlords and victimized tenants. If the tenant's attorney could somehow convince a sympathetic jury, probably tenants themselves, that a harassment case had merit, we'd automatically be denied our demolition application. The tenants of 100 Central Park South wouldn't have to move. In the meantime, they could generate plenty of negative press about me merely by alleging that I was harassing them. The fact that I denied the charges would only make it a juicier story. Unfortunately, we made several moves that played right into the tenants' hands. For example, we decided to bring eviction proceedings against any tenant at 100 Central Park South who was in significant arrears on his rent, or who wasn't using the apartment as a primary residence, as required by law. Landlords all over the city bring these proceedings every day. They are perfectly legitimate, and we won in several instances. Stupidly, we also brought several cases that were flawed. In one, for example, we claimed that a tenant hadn't paid his rent. It turned out that he had his canceled check as evidence, and the payment simply hadn't been recorded in Citadel's books. When they realized the error, they told the tenant they'd drop the action if he produced the check. By then, however, the tenant's lawyer saw a perfect opportunity to further demonstrate their case. The tenant refused to produce the check, and obviously, we lost this case in court. In another situation, we failed to give a tenant sufficient legal notice of an impending eviction proceeding. Our case was legitimate, but the court ruled that we should have known the law had been changed recently to require longer notice. Another mistake was tinning up the windows of vacant apartments. It happens to be exactly what the city does with its own vacant apartments all over the city to protect them from vandalism. But then the city doesn't own buildings on Central Park South. It would have been smarter, and it would have saved us a lot of trouble, if we'd come up with a nicer way to deal with the windows from the start. Nothing generated as much controversy is my offer to provide housing for the homeless at 100 Central Park South. By the summer of 1982, about a year after I took over the building, the problem of the homeless in New York was beginning to get a lot of attention. One morning, after passing several homeless people sleeping on benches in Central Park, I got an idea. I had more than a dozen vacant apartments at 100 Central Park South. Because I still planned to demolish the building, I had no intention of filling the apartments with permanent tenants. Why not, I thought, offer them to the city for use by the homeless on a temporary basis? I'm not going to pretend that it bothered me to imagine the very wealthy tenants of 100 Central Park South having to live alongside people less fortunate than themselves for a while. At the same time, I genuinely felt it was a shame not to make use of a few vacant apartments when the streets were filled with homeless people. Almost immediately, the columnists and editorial writers criticized my offer. City officials, sensing a potential controversy, told me, "No thanks." It didn't help make my offer seem sincere when one columnist wrote a story saying that I'd refused a subsequent plea by a group representing Polish refugees seeking to use the apartments. In fact, by then, I'd had second thoughts about the whole concept. My attorneys had researched the situation and determined that if I permitted anyone to move into the apartments, even on a temporary basis, I'd have a very hard time ever getting them out legally. That was all I needed. Saying so publicly, however, might just have made a bad situation worse. Instead, I said nothing, which wasn't much better. It was not one of my best experiences with the media, but it taught me something. You don't act on an impulse, even a charitable one, unless you've considered the downside. Early in 1984, a group of tenants went to the state and officially filed charges of harassment. Virtually all of the complaints were trivial. But I told my people to take care of every one, nonetheless. Even that wasn't enough. In January 1985, the state agreed to consider the tenants' charges of harassment. Obviously, we'd made our share of mistakes early on. But none had caused anyone real hardship. In my view, the tenants' tactics were a clever form of reverse harassment. They knew there had been no real harassment. The case instead was a ploy to hold on to their bargain apartments. Or at the very least, to exact a rich settlement from me. The tenants' committee orchestrated the campaign. Nearly 50 tenants were part of the harassment action, and all of them submitted identical boilerplate lists of complaints. They even ended their letters with the same phrase, "Donald Trump is a modern-day Scrooge." When my attorneys did a little further checking, they found out something very interesting. Several of the wealthier tenants had been submitting the same sort of complaints to city agencies for the past 10, 20, and even 30 years, invariably accompanied by a request for a reduction in rent. The tenants of 100 Central Park South were world experts in the art of living very high for very little. What the tenants didn't count on is that I'm not one of those landlords who roll over to avoid bad publicity or save a few bucks, particularly when I think the charges are unfair. Fighting back might run up my legal bills and even make me rethink my strategy. But the one thing I wasn't about to do was allow myself to be blackmailed into a ridiculous settlement. A couple of things did go my way. The most important was the value of New York real estate. It had risen steadily every year since 1974. But in early 1981, about the time I bought the two buildings on Central Park South, it finally took a pause. Over the next 2 years, during which I'd originally hoped to get my new building finished, the market actually declined. A lot of people thought the big boom was over. In 1984, however, the market picked up again strongly. The economics were staggering. In the fall of 1981, the average price per room for a cooperative reached as high as $93,000. By early 1983, it dropped as low as $67,000. But by January 1985, when my confrontation with the tenants was reaching a head, the average price per room had jumped up to $124,000. In short, while the tenants were doing all they could to delay me, New York real estate was nearly doubling in value. Even by building only on the Barbizon site, which I decided was the easiest solution, I'd earn more than if I'd developed the entire site 2 years earlier. In addition, we now had numerous vacant apartments at 100 Central Park South, and with time, the number could only rise. The law permitted us to rent some vacant apartments at market rates. In effect, I was sitting on gold. The other thing that happened during this period is that architectural tastes and trends began to shift. At the time I purchased the buildings on Central Park South, the style in skyscrapers was still very much the sleek, highly modern glass tower. Trump Tower was perhaps the ultimate example, because that design was so well received and so successful, it seemed to me only logical to design a similarly sleek modern building on the Central Park South site. By 1984, however, I sensed a new wave in architecture was setting in, and it was the wave of the old. The people who buy top-line apartments in New York tend to be extremely fashion-conscious, in architecture as in everything else. I'm a practical man. If an older look is what people want, that's what I'm going to provide. I'm not interested in buildings that don't sell. Early in 1985, I commissioned an architect to design a new building for the Barbizon Plaza site, but one that incorporated older, classical elements compatible with 100 Central Park South. In truth, my heart wasn't totally in it. I'd never been a big fan of postmodernism, the architectural movement that first mixed classical elements with modern design. To me, it often represents the worst of both worlds, The materials and the craftsmanship are rarely first class, because most builders won't pay what that requires. And the classical elements in postmodern designs almost always look imitative. At the same time, these elements interfere with the sleek look of the best modern design. When my architect showed up with his model for an older-looking building on the Barbizon site, the design was not the first thing that caught my eye. The new building, I noticed, was much smaller than the one it was intended to replace. What, I asked the architect, was this all about? It's the zoning, he explained. When the Barbizon was built, there were no restrictions on size. Now that the zoning is so much stricter, it's no longer permissible to build such a large building on that site. Do you mean, I said, that if I totally gut and rebuild the inside and leave only the facade and the steel frame intact, that is okay? But if I tear down the old building, I have to replace it with a much smaller and less dramatic new one? And he said, yes, Mr. Trump, that is correct. If that's the case, I said, then why should we knock down an old building to build a new one that will be less than half the size, won't look nearly as good as the old one, and will cost a lot more? It's simple, Mr. Trump, he said. The reason is that the windows in the Barbizon are much too small for a luxury residential building. The solution was obvious. Leave the building intact, but cut out bigger openings and enlarge the windows. Coincidentally, my own tastes were changing. I was beginning to appreciate the detailing and elegance of certain great older buildings. Among them were the two buildings I owned on Central Park South. I also began to realize how much a part of the Central Park South skyline these buildings were. Our preliminary estimate for ripping down the Barbizon and putting up a new structure in its place was $250 million. When we costed out the job of gutting and rebuilding the interior and enlarging all the windows, we came up with an estimate of $100 million for the entire job. The cost of trying to replicate my favorite feature of the Barbizon, the magnificent stone crown at its top, was $10 million alone. Even at that, it would never have matched the original. Renovating wasn't only cost-effective, it was also a better design decision. One last factor helped turn the whole deal around. For several years, I'd been trying to purchase the St. Moritz Hotel, directly across the street from 100 Central Park South. The sellers were Harry Helmsley and Lawrence Wien, two of the greatest real estate men ever. The problem had always been cost. They wanted a huge price for the hotel, which I believe was more than its earnings justified. Several times they made deals with other buyers, presumably for what they were seeking, only to have the agreements unravel before closing. Time and again I've seen that happen with people who offer a top price for a property. Their eyes prove bigger than their pocketbooks, and they end up backing out. After watching this process repeat itself several times, I called Harry Helmsley and said, I'd very much like to buy the St. Moritz, and in my case, you know the deal will go through, but I don't want to pay the price you have in mind. And he said, well, what you're offering is too low. We negotiated back and forth, and finally we settled on a price that I think was fair, based on the hotel's earnings. But I had an ace in the hole. The 1,400-room Barbizon Plaza, one door up the street. I hadn't told anyone, but my plan was to close down the Barbizon as soon as I purchased the St. Moritz. The logic was simple. When I closed the Barbizon, I could move Charles Frohenfeld, a great hotel manager, and all of his best people over to the St. Moritz. In addition, many of the Barbizon's customers would inevitably follow, since the St. Moritz was the only other moderate-price hotel on Central Park South. While I'd obviously lose some customers when I closed down the Barbizon, I'd pick up a lot of them at the St. Moritz. At the very least, I figured occupancy and revenues at the St. Moritz would increase by 25% virtually overnight. The banks apparently agreed. When I went seeking financing for the purchase, I was able to get an immediate commitment for $6 million more than my purchase price. In short, I was able to buy the St. Moritz without putting up any money at all. And I ended up with $6 million to put in my pocket. When we got to closing, Harry Helmsley was leafing through the papers, and he noticed the size of my mortgage. He didn't look thrilled, but the sale was also a great deal for Harry and Larry. After all, they'd paid practically nothing to purchase the hotel years earlier. I took over the St. Moritz in September 1985 and closed the Barbizon soon after. During the first year, business at the St. Moritz increased by 31%, or slightly more than I'd predicted. But by virtue of more efficient management, the margin of profit nearly quadrupled. The one remaining issue I faced was the harassment suit at 100 Central Park South. Because I no longer intended to vacate and raise the building, a harassment finding no longer threatened my plans. Still, several of my lawyers urged me to settle the case purely to resolve an unpleasant situation. Specifically, they suggested I work out a deal under which the tenants would drop their harassment suit in return for my selling them the building outright for $10 million. On its face, the deal wasn't a bad one for me. Based on my original purchase price, I stood to earn a very substantial profit by selling 100 Central Park South for $10 million. But in the end, I said no. Temperamentally, I just couldn't accept the idea that the tenants were using harassment charges as a lever against me so that they could buy a building for less than market value. This is where the tenants and their lawyers caused themselves the loss of a tremendous windfall. Today, in New York, almost everyone wants to buy their apartments. Meanwhile, the harassment case stalled in the courts. A state Supreme Court judge ruled in August 1985 that there was no clear evidence that harassment had occurred. In December 1986, the appellate division of the state Supreme Court unanimously upheld the lower court's ruling. The lawyers kept talking settlement. Finally, late in 1986, nearly all the tenants agreed to drop any further claims against me. Since I no longer planned to demolish the building anyway, I agreed to drop all eviction proceedings and to give them new leases on their apartments. I also agreed to excuse from 3 months' rent every tenant who was party to the agreement, and in return, all tenants who'd been withholding rent, in some cases for as long as a year, agreed to pay up. The total figure exceeded $150,000. While the state dropped its case, the city insisted that it intended to continue pursuing the harassment case against me. Even John Moore, the leader of the tenants' group, was surprised. "For the city to push the case," he said to a reporter, "is like beating the horse after the horse has come back to the barn." The real victims were the taxpayers. The city was choosing to spend money and manpower on a non-issue that had been resolved, at a time when many important issues had not. It is my opinion that this case continues purely because I beat the hell out of Ed Koch on the Trump Tower tax abatement and embarrassed him with Woolman Rink. In the meantime, I renamed the Barbizon Plaza Trump Park and began my renovation. One of the first things I did was to hire a company called Holes, Inc. Talk about surreal specialization. These people did nothing but cut holes for a living. Fortunately, they did it very well. In a matter of weeks, they turned the Barbizon's tiny windows into huge picture window openings. Those openings alone were immensely valuable, because a great view is worth a small fortune. In a market about to be flooded with new buildings, we had something unique to offer. The best of the old and the new. The detail and ornamentation of the building's exterior remained, including the crown. So did features such as the 12-foot ceilings in the apartments, which no developer would even consider in a new building, because the cost is simply too great. At the same time, the new construction gave the building several advantages over most older ones. New plumbing, smooth walls, modern wiring, fast elevators, and, of course, huge thermopane windows. The building is scheduled to be completed in the fall of 1987, but we put the apartments on the market in November 1986. Within 8 months, we'd sold 80%, nearly 270 apartments. One individual bought 7 apartments for a total of $20 million, When the building sells out, in all likelihood before a single person has moved in, we'll have grossed in excess of $240 million. And that's before I do anything with 100 Central Park South and the stores along the street. All's well that ends well. The tenants at 100 Central Park South kept their apartments. Central Park South retained two of its landmark buildings. And the city will soon be earning far greater taxes from the property than ever before. As for me, I'll ultimately earn a profit of more than $100 million on a deal that many people thought would turn out to be a total loser. And it was largely because the tenants managed to delay me. Chapter 11. Long Shot. The Spring and Fall of the USFL. All my life, I believed in paying for the best. But when it came to the United States Football League, I decided to go a different route entirely. By the time I bought the New Jersey Generals in the fall of 1983, the league was already failing badly. It had lost nearly $30 million. The Generals alone, under the ownership of an Oklahoma oil man named J. Walter Duncan, had lost more than $2 million, not to mention nearly every game they'd played. In real estate terms, I was buying the South Bronx instead of Fifth Avenue and 57th Street. But I didn't look at the Generals as a typical deal. I viewed it instead as a long shot, a lark, that I could afford to take. I've always been a football fan. I love sports, and having my own team seemed the realization of a great fantasy. I also liked the idea of taking on the NFL, a smug, self-satisfied monopoly that I believed was highly vulnerable to an aggressive competitor. As long shots go, I liked the odds on the USFL. My initial investment was relatively small, and the potential rewards were quite great. For less than $6 million, contingent on the league's continuing, compared with the $70 million an NFL franchise might cost, I was able to purchase a professional football team in one of the greatest areas in the world. If I could help turn the team and the league around, I stood to earn back many times my initial investment. At the very least, I would have a lot of fun trying. The main problems with the USFL seemed fairly clear-cut and not all that difficult to remedy. The first was that the league was playing its games in the spring. Sports have their seasons, and fans like their football in the fall. The television networks, which essentially underwrite professional sports, won't pay large sums for the rights to televise spring football. At the time I bought the Generals, ABC was paying $1 million a year for exclusive network rights to the USFL spring schedule. Meanwhile, the three networks together were paying a staggering $359 million a year for rights to the NFL fall games. The first thing the USFL had to do was move to the fall. The second challenge was to build a first-class product. To me, that meant spending whatever money it took to sign top players, promote our teams, and create the sort of excitement that would make us a legitimate competitor for the NFL's fans and TV dollars. Two leagues had been launched previously in competition with the NFL, and the outcome in each case was highly instructive. The American Football League was formed in 1962 by eight very wealthy entrepreneurial men. They signed top players and absorbed substantial losses in the service of building the league's credibility during the early years. By 1966, the AFL had signed away dozens of the NFL's best players and was widely seen as the more exciting of the two leagues. With the AFL raids escalating, NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle surrendered. He suggested a merger of the two leagues, and today those original AFL teams are among the NFL's most successful franchises. But even without a merger, the AFL would have prospered. The other venture that tried to compete with the NFL was the World Football League. It was launched in 1973, but by men of much less wealth and more limited vision. In contrast to their AFL counterparts, the WFL owners signed very few name players, place their franchises in smaller cities, and failed to attract any kind of television contract. Within 2 years, the WFL was bankrupt. Its founders didn't lose a fortune, but only because they didn't invest a fortune. I foresaw two possible outcomes if we moved the USFL to the fall and began to build quality teams, and both of them were potentially good. The first was that at least one of the three networks would offer us a substantial fall television contract, which would help us continue to build an even stronger league fully competitive with the NFL. The second was that the three networks, all fearful of alienating the monopoly NFL, would refuse to give us a fall television contract, no matter how strong a product we had to offer. In that case, I believed we'd have strong grounds for an antitrust case against the NFL. If we went the latter route, obviously we could lose, and then our league would be dead. But I believe the more likely outcome was some sort of victory. If the suit went to a jury and we were awarded reasonable damages, particularly given the fact that any damage award is trebled in an antitrust case, we'd have the financial base we needed. Another possibility was that the NFL, anticipating a costly and humiliating court defeat, would offer some sort of settlement, much as they'd done 20 years earlier with the AFL. I made no secret of my views. 2 years later, the NFL would try to claim in court that my plan to move our league season to the fall was somehow secret and sinister. In fact, within days of taking over the Generals, I told any reporter who called me exactly how I felt. Then on October 18, 1983, a month after purchasing the Generals, I attended my first owners' meeting in Houston, Texas. I wasn't shy there, either. When my turn came to address my fellow owners, I stood up and explained that I hadn't bought into the USFL to be a minor league owner playing in the off-season of spring. I pointed out that the greatest number of fans, and by far the biggest pool of network television dollars, were concentrated in the fall. I reminded my fellow owners that because the NFL had just gone through a long, bitter player strike the past fall, many fans were feeling restless and alienated. And finally, I argued that we had a chance to put the NFL even further on the defensive by moving aggressively to sign top NFL players whose contracts were coming up, as well as the best graduating college players. If there was a single key miscalculation I made with the USFL, it was evaluating the strength of my fellow owners. In any partnership, you're only as strong as your weakest link. Several of my fellow USFL owners were strong as hell financially and psychologically. Among them were Michigan Panthers owner Al Taubman and Philadelphia Stars owner Miles Tannenbaum, both of whom, coincidentally, had made their personal fortunes building shopping centers, as well as Memphis Showboats owner Billy Donovant and Jacksonville Bulls owner Fred Bullard. Unfortunately, I quickly discovered that a number of USFL owners lacked the financial resources and the competitive vision to build the sort of top-quality league necessary to defeat the NFL. They shuddered at the prospect of any direct confrontation with the NFL. They were quite content to play in obscurity in the spring, and they spent much more time thinking about ways to keep their costs down than about how to build the league up. My most immediate priority was the team I'd just purchased. The New Jersey Generals were a disaster. They'd just come off a season in which they'd won only 4 games and lost 14. The team had one great athlete and superstar, Herschel Walker, the Heisman Trophy running back from Georgia. But even Herschel had yet to play near his potential. Meanwhile, although the Generals had just completed a full season of playing professional football across the river from the media capital of the world, they had attracted virtually no press attention and very few fans. The best way to turn that around was to turn the Generals around. Fans like winners. They come to watch stars, great, exciting players who do great, exciting things. Herschel was obviously one, but in football, the team rises or falls on the quarterback. Nothing helped promote the AFL and the New York Jets as much as the signing of a University of Alabama quarterback named Joe Namath for a then-unprecedented $400,000 a year. Namath eventually led the Jets and the AFL to their first Super Bowl victory. But even before that, he earned his salary simply because he became the AFL's most colorful, charismatic drawing card. The first player I went after was Brian Sipe, the quarterback for the Cleveland Browns. Sipe had been the NFL's most valuable player a couple of seasons earlier, and he was a bona fide superstar. He was also in the option year of his contract, meaning that he'd be available in a matter of months. Getting Sipe was a chance to help the Generals and the USFL, and simultaneously to hurt the NFL. The negotiations proved to be long and difficult, but on December 27, 1983, I held a press conference to announce we'd signed Sipe to a long-term $800,000-a-year contract with the Generals. By the time we got Sipe, we'd already lured away several other top NFL players. The first was Gary Barbaro, an all-pro free safety from the Kansas City Chiefs, whom we signed on November 5th. Signing Barbaro had a side benefit. It showed other NFL players that we were serious about paying top dollar to build a top team. On November 28th, we signed Kerry Justin, who'd been a starting cornerback for the Seattle Seahawks. In December, we signed a pair of linebackers from the Super Bowl champion San Francisco 49ers, Willie Harper and Bobby Leopold. To protect Sipe, we signed a veteran offensive guard from Cincinnati named Dave Lapham. Another negotiation that got some attention during that period was the one I conducted with Don Shula, coach of the Miami Dolphins. Shula was one of the most successful coaches in NFL history, but he was also vastly underpaid. I immediately offered Shula far more than he'd been earning. I was willing to meet most of his demands. But when he threw in a request for an apartment in Trump Tower, I drew the line. I can afford to buy football teams in part because I don't give away apartments. Still, the negotiation ended up helping Shula. It forced the Dolphins to renegotiate his contract at a far higher salary, which he certainly deserved. We got the most attention of all for signing Lawrence Taylor, the all-pro linebacker for the New York Giants and perhaps the best all-around player in the NFL. On December 31st, 1983, we announced that Taylor had signed a four-year contract with the Generals for a total of $3.25 million. The catch was that it wouldn't take effect until 1988. When his contract with the Giants expired. In a way, that was even better than getting him immediately. By signing a player of Taylor's stature to a futures contract, we were serving notice on the NFL that none of their players, not even those under multi-year contracts, were beyond our reach. As it turned out, when Taylor's deal was announced, the Giants went nuts. 2 weeks later, on January 17, 1984, they offered him a six-year, $6.55 million extension of his contract. In effect, I forced the Giants to increase Taylor's salary by $3 million just to prevent him from departing 3 years down the road. Then, in return for my letting Taylor out of his general's contract, the Giants agreed to pay me a penalty fee of $750,000. My aggressiveness in signing NFL players also seemed to inspire other USFL owners. The second USFL draft was held on January 4, 1984. The Pittsburgh franchise drafted Heisman Trophy winner Mike Rozier from Nebraska and signed him 5 days later. The team's season ticket sales immediately jumped from 6,000 to 20,000. Brigham Young quarterback Steve Young, a college superstar, signed a multi-million dollar contract with the USFL's Los Angeles Express. Don Klosterman, the president of the LA Express, also managed to sign 14 other draft picks, every one of whom was a good NFL prospect. Altogether, USFL teams signed nearly half of the top college players we went after. Sports Illustrated posed the obvious question in an article about the success of our draft. How many more players like Rozier and Young can the NFL afford to lose? When our owners met in New Orleans on January 17th, I pushed again to move our season to the fall. Given our success in luring NFL players and signing top college prospects, the time couldn't have been better. I suggested a fall vote right then and there, but the reluctant owners managed to vote through a compromise instead, appointing a long-range planning committee to study the spring-fall question. To me, committees are what insecure people create in order to put off making hard decisions. But at least I'd gotten the fall question on the table as a serious issue. I was made a member of the new committee, and I was confident I'd ultimately persuade a majority of owners that the fall was our best hope. Meanwhile, the NFL was beginning to run scared. The best evidence was a meeting the league held in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in February 1984, to discuss its future, and specifically the threat of the USFL. The main seminar, which we didn't learn about until much later, was conducted by a highly respected Harvard Business School professor named Michael Porter, who had prepared a 47-page document entitled The USFL versus the NFL. Some 65 NFL executives attended his presentation, among them Jack Donlin, executive director of the NFL Management Council, as well as numerous team owners. Porter bluntly outlined a multi-part plan for declaring total war on our league by employing numerous anti-competitive strategies. His 2.5-hour presentation was divided into sections such as offensive strategies, guerrilla warfare, and the art of war, China 500 BC. Porter's suggestions included trying to dissuade ABC from continuing even its spring television contract with the USFL, encouraging USFL players to unionize in order to drive up our costs, and attempting to co-opt the most powerful and influential USFL owners by offering them NFL franchises. As we launched our second season in the spring of 1984, we weren't yet aware of the NFL's secret campaign to destroy us, but we were probably feeling its effects. Several of our more vulnerable owners, most particularly those in Chicago, Washington, San Antonio, and Oklahoma, had begun to experience severe financial problems. The danger to the league was less losing a couple of franchises than having our credibility damaged. As long as we had problems, it was difficult to get the press to focus on our stronger teams. Instead, sports writers wrote about declining attendance in the weaker cities, and the personal financial problems some owners were having. Meanwhile, as I feared, the long-range planning study dragged on. A majority of owners had voted to hire an outside consultant, McKinsey & Company, to conduct the study. McKinsey is probably the best in its business, but I like consultants even less than I like committees. When it comes to making a smart decision, the most distinguished planning committee working with the highest price consultants doesn't hold a candle to a group of guys with a reasonable amount of common sense and their own money on the line. McKinsey's study took 3 months and cost a princely $600,000. Finally, on the morning of August 22, 1984, McKinsey executive Sharon Patrick presented her conclusions to the USFL owners, who had gathered in Chicago. The league's best hope, she told us, was to continue to play in the spring, to limit expenditures severely, and perhaps to consider a move to the fall somewhere down the line. Among other things, she reported that a majority of fans who'd been surveyed in a poll wanted the USFL to stay in the spring. You can probably guess how much stock I put in polls. The reality was that we just couldn't afford to adopt the McKinsey conclusions. Even if we cut our losses in the spring, there was no foreseeable chance of making a profit, and a lot of our weaker owners couldn't afford to lose another dime. We needed to take radical action. And that's what I stood up and said. Within 2 hours of Patrick's presentation, I managed to get the issue of moving to the fall put to a vote. It passed by more than the required two-thirds majority. That same afternoon, we announced the decision to take effect following one last spring season. The other thing we began to discuss at the meeting was bringing an antitrust suit against the NFL. Specifically, we authorized our commissioner, Chet Simmons, to send NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle a letter putting the NFL on notice. Simmons stated our views gently. The position of the USFL as a new sports enterprise and the market position of the NFL make it essential to the survival of the USFL that the NFL and the NFL owners operate within the bounds of the laws and regulations which govern the conduct of a business having a dominant market position. Put more bluntly, our message was this: if you try to hurt us, we'll sue you. By October, it was clear that something had changed dramatically in the tenor of our discussions with CBS and NBC. So long as we were just considering a move to the fall, both networks seemed interested in discussing a deal. No sooner did we announce our move, however, than they'd both backed off totally. It was obvious to me that the NFL was putting enormous pressure on the networks not to do business with us in the fall, particularly on ABC, with whom we already had a contract for the spring. Pete Rozelle later testified that he'd never even discussed the issue with Rune Arledge, the head of ABC Sports. To me, that was preposterous. Rozelle and Arledge are longtime colleagues and good friends. Would anyone seriously believe that Rozelle, highly concerned about the implications of the USFL's move to the fall, wouldn't make his views known to his friend Arledge? And is it really possible that Arledge, a man who made millions of dollars for ABC by inventing NFL Monday Night Football, wouldn't be highly concerned with keeping Rozelle happy? The irony is that all three networks, not just ABC, but NBC and CBS as well, were actually losing money on NFL games. After total rights fees in excess of $350 million a year, the networks, by their own estimates, lost many millions televising games during 1985. Even so, no network wanted to risk alienating the NFL. Football is the prestige TV sport, and in order to remain competitive with one another, the three networks were resigned to carrying the NFL as a loss leader. As for the USFL, we were left with no option. On October 17, 1984, we filed an antitrust suit in the Southern District Court of New York. Specifically, we asked that the NFL be limited to contracts with no more than two of the networks, and that we be awarded damages of $1.32 billion. In the meantime, we had a more immediate problem: staying alive. On January 3, 1985, the USFL held its third draft of college seniors. While the Generals had improved greatly to 9-5 and averaged more than 40,000 fans a game, other teams were falling more deeply into the red. We very much needed a shot in the arm. My own solution was to go after the best and most exciting college senior. There was little doubt who that was. Doug Flutie of Boston College was a lock to win the Heisman Trophy. In his final game, playing against the University of Miami on national television, Flutie capped his career by throwing a last-second 50-yard bomb for a touchdown, giving Boston College a 47-45 victory. Very quickly, the pass became one of those instant replay classics, transforming Flutie into an overnight sports legend. I must have seen the pass at least two dozen times on various newscasts and sports shows. I also liked the fact that Flutie had great media potential. He was good-looking, well-spoken, and gutsy, the sort of guy the press loves to write about. There were two minor problems. One was that the Generals already had a very talented quarterback named Brian Sipe. The other was that Doug Flutie stood just 5'10" and weighed only 170 pounds. A number of scouts were skeptical that he could make it in the pros, where virtually every defensive lineman is 6'6" and weighs at least 260 pounds. In the end, I went with my instincts. Brian Sipe was a proven star, but he was also 35 years old, and his best years were probably behind him. Doug Flutie, on the other hand, had the potential to become the USFL's Joe Namath. In the worst case, he'd generate a lot of press, which would help the Generals' season ticket sales and the image of the league generally. In the best case, he'd be a great player, too. On February 5th, we signed Flutie to a 5-year contract at over $1 million a year, which I personally guaranteed. I don't like to do that, but a player of Flutie's stature wasn't about to risk signing with the financially shaky league unless he had some guarantees. If the league ever did go under, I figured, I could sell his contract to an NFL team. On February 6th, I solved the issue of Brian Sipe by trading him to the Jacksonville Bulls. I wasn't about to have a very highly paid quarterback sitting on the bench. Flutie made his debut on February 24th in an away game against the Birmingham Stallions. He started slow, but came on very strong, and almost pulled out a victory by leading the Generals to 3 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. As for his box office value, it was even greater than I expected. The game was televised by ABC and drew a 9 rating, nearly twice what we'd averaged the previous season. 2 other notable events occurred that first weekend of the season, both having to do with quarterbacks. One was the opening game performance of a quarterback named Jim Kelly of the Houston Gamblers. Kelly threw for 574 yards and 5 touchdowns, proving that he was as good as any quarterback in either league. Unfortunately, the other quarterback news was not good. Brian Sipe, playing his first game for Jacksonville, suffered a separated shoulder, which seemed almost certain to end his season, and perhaps his career. On March 10th, we had our home opener against the LA Express. If I had to pick a high point for the USFL, it was probably that game. Over 60,000 fans turned up, anticipating a duel between the newcomer Flutie and the USFL's best proven quarterback, Steve Young. Both players put on dazzling shows, and better yet, the Generals came out on top. Flutie threw for 2 fourth-quarter touchdowns to give us the victory, 35-24. The day after Flutie's great game, I wrote a letter to Harry Usher, our new commissioner, suggesting that the cost of Flutie's contract be shared among all USFL owners, on the grounds that Flutie's promotional value was league-wide. I knew it was highly unlikely that the other owners would go along, and they didn't. But my attitude is that you can't get hurt asking. Flutie, Kelly, and Young represented the good news about the USFL. The bad news was that we were still stuck with a lot of weak teams led by mediocre quarterbacks. My worst fears about the consequences of having weak partners came true midway through our 1985 season. John Bassett was the owner of the USFL franchise in Tampa Bay. Previously, he'd been one of the founders of the ill-fated World Football League. From the very start, Bassett and I had been on opposite sides of nearly every issue, and specifically, the move to the fall. I'd managed to bring the majority of my fellow owners over to my way of thinking. But Bassett never stopped fighting me, though he finally, reluctantly, did vote with a majority. Despite our disagreements, I liked him personally, and I felt sympathetic to his situation. On this Sunday afternoon in late March, it was widely known within the league that Bassett had cancer, that he was fighting for his life, and that his behavior had become increasingly unpredictable during the previous few months. What I'll never know is whether Bassett's illness affected his judgment that day. In any case, Bassett agreed to be interviewed by ABC announcer Keith Jackson, who began by asking what he thought was wrong with the USFL. What followed was a tirade. Before a national TV audience, Bassett viciously criticized the concept of moving the USFL to the fall. He called the league its own worst enemy. He said the USFL was guilty of mismanagement and virtually every other horrible sin he could conjure up. I caught the interview on a TV monitor in the press box, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. My first thought was that Bassett would make a great witness for the NFL in our antitrust suit. My second thought was that he was just a terribly frustrated man, thoughtlessly venting anger. If any one person had the potential to offset the damage wrought by Bassett and our other weaker owners, it was probably Harvey Meyerson, the attorney we hired in the middle of 1985 to take over our antitrust case. Meyerson was the head of the litigation department at the firm Finley Kumble, and he was an expert in antitrust litigation. He also had the sort of pugnacious, confrontational attitude you need when you're the underdog taking on the establishment. Most of the other USFL owners had long since written off the possibility that we'd win the antitrust suit. The NFL, they believed, was just too entrenched. But from the first time Meyerson met us in April 1985, he told us he felt we had a very strong case. He said that we should pull out all the stops to bring it to trial, and that there was a better-than-even chance we'd win. In the meantime, one bright spot amidst all the USFL's troubles was the fact that the Generals, and specifically Herschel Walker, were playing so well. For the first 2 weeks of the season, Herschel simply wasn't being utilized. He'd call me up in my office, depressed, and say, "Mr. Trump, I can run over these guys if they just give me the ball." I ranted and raved to our coach, Walt Michaels, but it wasn't until I literally threatened to fire him that he got the point. In the seventh game of the season, Herschel was finally let loose. He ran the ball 30 times for almost 250 yards, setting a league record. In each of the next 10 games, he ran for more than 100 yards. By the end of the season, he'd racked up 2,411 yards. That broke the all-time professional football rushing record, held previously by Eric Dickerson of the NFL. I got a great kick out of that. Unfortunately, Doug Flutie was injured late in the 1985 season, and that almost certainly cost us the USFL championship. In the playoffs, we lost by 3 points to the transplanted Baltimore Stars, while Flutie stood on the sidelines. In February 1986, we agreed to reduce the number of USFL teams from 14 to 8. In the process, we weeded out the owners with the biggest financial problems. We also consolidated our strengths. The Houston Gamblers, for example, merged with my Generals. As a result, we created a dream backfield that I'm convinced had no equal in professional football. Herschel Walker at running back and Jim Kelly at quarterback. The other teams that survived the consolidation were also all among our strongest and most popular. Memphis, Baltimore, Jacksonville, Tampa, Orlando, Arizona, and Birmingham. In April, we got more good news when a federal judge named Peter Leisure set a jury trial to begin the next month in our antitrust suit against the NFL. That ensured us a verdict before the start of our first fall season. If we won the suit, we'd be in great shape to launch. If we lost, I considered it highly unlikely that the USFL could survive. But at least we'd finally be able to cut our losses. The future of the USFL now rested in the hands of the 6 jurors chosen to hear our case. The jury system is designed to ensure the fairest possible trial. The problem is that a pool of randomly selected jurors isn't necessarily qualified to make judgments on complicated issues. Sometimes that isn't bad, particularly if you have a case that's weak and a lawyer who is very persuasive. The problem is unpredictability. You can have a great case and come out a loser, and you can have a terrible case but come out a winner. We got to present our side first, and very quickly, a consensus formed in the courtroom that Harvey Meyerson was beating the living daylights out of the NFL. He put Commissioner Pete Rozelle on the stand and almost literally took him apart. For 26 years, Rozelle had been running the NFL very successfully and very smoothly. Of course, you don't have to be a genius to run a monopoly. Put that same man up against a tough competitor, and it may be a whole different story. Meyerson pressed, and Rozelle got flustered. He mumbled, stumbled, and spoke badly. He turned red, and he took back statements. At times, he appeared to be flat-out lying. Halfway through his week of cross-examination, Rozelle had become physically sick. His performance was so weak that I found myself actually feeling sorry for him. In retrospect, however, I realized that the jury probably felt at least as sorry for Rozelle as I did. And that may well have helped save the NFL's case. Rozelle was least credible, I thought, when he talked about the Harvard seminar entitled "The USFL versus the NFL, the Linchpin of Our Case." Roselle claimed he hadn't known anything about the seminar, and that he got physically ill when he first heard about it, weeks after the fact. "To your stomach, sir?" asked Harvey Meyerson, totally deadpan. "Yes," said Roselle. "I see," said Meyerson. "How long did it take you to recover?" "About half a day," Roselle replied. I doubt that a single person in the courtroom believed Roselle during that exchange. At another point, Meyerson introduced some devastatingly incriminating comments that Roselle had made before a congressional committee back in 1961. At the time, the NFL's games were being shown on just one network, CBS. "If all the networks were tied up by one football league," a senator asked Roselle during his testimony, "wouldn't the other league possibly be at a major competitive disadvantage?" "I should certainly think so," Roselle said quickly, adding, "there is no intention on our part of using more than one network." By 1987, of course, the NFL had all three networks tied up. Didn't that put our league at a major competitive disadvantage? Roselle could only hem and haw. The one time I myself directly contradicted Roselle's testimony was over his description of a meeting the two of us had in March 1984. At the time, the USFL owners were still debating whether to move to the fall. The Porter seminar at Harvard had taken place several weeks earlier, and one of Porter's main strategies for destroying the USFL had been to try to co-opt the strongest USFL franchise owners by promising us NFL franchises. At Roselle's suggestion, I rented a suite at the Pierre Hotel for a meeting on March 12th. I like to keep every option open in life, and I was certainly interested in what the commissioner of the NFL had on his mind. Roselle testified at the trial that during our meeting I told him I was interested in purchasing an NFL franchise, and that I'd get out of the USFL if I could get into the NFL. It was ridiculous on the face of it. I never had any interest in owning a football franchise outside of the New York area, and I had long since determined that neither of the two New York-based NFL teams, the Giants or the Jets, was up for sale. What really happened at the meeting is that Roselle tried to woo me, plain and simple. He said he considered me a good candidate for an NFL franchise, whether it was the Generals, through merger, or an NFL team, which he said he could help me get. In return, he said, he wanted two things: that the USFL not move to the fall, and that the league not bring an antitrust suit against the NFL. I had no doubt about what Roselle was up to. He was testing the waters. If he could get rid of the USFL merely by absorbing a couple of our teams into the NFL, he was prepared to do that, I'm certain. At the same time, by merely dangling an offer, he gave himself deniability, in the event that I turned him down. That's exactly what I did. Sure enough, he rewrote the story of our meeting. We called 18 witnesses in all during the first month of the trial, and we scored a lot of points. Meyerson showed how the NFL had bullied the three networks into refusing to consider giving the USFL a TV contract. He showed why the USFL could not survive without such a contract. He offered endless evidence, led by the Porter study, that the NFL had consciously and illegally set out to destroy the USFL. By the time we'd finished presenting our witnesses, even the press was beginning to sense the possibility that we might win the case. The headline of a story in Sports Illustrated caught the mood best. "Give the first round to the USFL," it said, followed by an even more devastating subhead: "The embattled younger league has scored tellingly against the NFL in the trial of its $1.32 billion antitrust suit. Now the NFL has the ball." Looking back, I think our strength may have backfired, just as the NFL's weakness ended up prompting the jury's sympathy. Meyerson's style, the silk handkerchief in the pocket of his perfectly tailored suit, his theatrical way of speaking, the methodical relentlessness of his attack, may have come off as too aggressive and too slick. By contrast, I think, the NFL came off as the beleaguered underdogs. Like Roselle, who became sick and was so unconvincing during his cross-examination, the NFL lawyer Frank Rothman was so weak and ashen-faced the last days of the trial that everyone, including me, felt very bad for him.